This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. My guest today is Dr. Michelle Phelps, Associate Professor of Sociology and Martindale Endowed Chair at the University of Minnesota. Michelle is author of The Minneapolis Reckoning, Race, Violence, and the Politics of Policing, which will be published in May 2024 by Princeton University Press. Phelps is co-author of Breaking the Pendulum, The Long Struggle Over Criminal Justice with Philip Goodman and Joshua Page, published by Oxford in 2017. Our conversation was recorded on Tuesday, April 16th, 2024. Today on The Annex, the roots of police reform, the attempt at police abolition, and the long-term effects of mobilizing for racial justice in Minneapolis. Stay with us. All right. Well, Dr. Michelle Phelps, welcome to The Annex. So good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. I'm a fan of the podcast, so it is exciting to be on the other side of it.
Well, it's always nice to hear people are listening to the show. And if you listen to the show, you know, like, rate, review, subscribe, all those things that all the podcasts I listen to keep talking about. And I managed never to say on the podcast, except for right now. Good to hear that. Thanks so much. I was really excited to read your book. It's brilliantly written, deeply researched. I honestly had a hard time putting it down. I read a lot of books, not only for the podcast, but in my academic life. And I can't always say that about the books that I read. The ones on the Annex, of course, are awesome. But your work on the politics of policing started well before George Floyd was murdered. Can you describe the project that you and your collaborators had been engaged in? Also, define the politics of policing and tell us how things started to shift in response to his murder and the resulting uprising.
Yeah. So first of all, thank you so much for having me and for the kind words. And on the writing piece, I do want to say, you didn't ask about this explicitly, but I will say, I mean, I think writing is so important for what public sociologists do, right? There was a podcast a couple of years ago about social movements, and it said, you have to make revolution irresistible. And I think the same is true of sociology, right? To the extent that we want public audiences for some of our work, and that doesn't need to be the goal for all of it, but it was for this book, it was very much intended to be a crossover audience, then we have to make the writing good. And I think people sometimes simplify that as you have to sensationalize or you have to simplify it. But I think some of it is just about good writing, and good writing takes time. It takes reading non-academic texts. It takes help, in my case, right? Working with editors, it's really essential. And so I think we need to have a broader conversation about what it means to do good, but still deep and rich and nuanced and sharply empirical scholarship when we're trying to write for public audiences. So this project, you know, people often ask me, did this project begin after the murder of George Floyd in, of course, summer 2020? And the answer was no. As you say, it started much earlier. I started thinking about this project all the way back in 2016. At the time, I was finishing my first book, Breaking the Pendulum. And that book was really about, the reason it's called Breaking the Pendulum is the idea was that we have this narrative of criminal justice practices as swinging like a pendulum between rehabilitative eras and more punitive eras. And the reason the book is called Breaking the Pendulum was our core argument was that instead of thinking about these kind of naturalistic swings, we really need to think about the actors who are on the ground at local, state, and federal levels who are doing the pushing of the swinging of this pendulum, right? It is actors who make penal history. And so we were finishing that book right when the initial kind of years, the first 2 years or so of the Black Lives Matter movement. And you can see in that book, in the conclusion, we start to think about, we were really focused on state level policies, particularly imprisonment in that book. But you can see us start to grapple with what would it mean to think about policing through this lens. And what I started to think about was that policing is really, unlike kind of state level correctional systems, policing is hyper local, right? There are more than 18,000 police departments across the country. Even a city like Minneapolis, we have not one police department, but multiple. The park system have their own police department. Several universities have their own police department, right? Like, we have a lot of these hyper-local agencies. And so I started to think about who are the key players who are shaping what is the definition of the problem in policing today, and what are its solutions, and how are they attempting to negotiate sort of who controls policing? And that was in part a response locally. So the BLM protests in Minneapolis really sparked in 2015 after the police killing of Jamar Clark in North Minneapolis. And so locally, I was really trying to understand sort of what can protests do to shift policing and who has that power. And so I developed this idea of the politics of policing, really drawing off of my work with Breaking the Pendulum, which drew on a field theory model, drawing on Bourdieu. So we were trying to think about like sort of who is in this field of policing, right? Who shapes how we think about the scope of police action, what good policing looks like. And I started to think about the politics as being driven, not a simple top-down process of like political elites are shaping police processes, but rather, right, what is the role of everyday residents in how they vote and how they call 911 and how they mobilize public safety? What is the residence of activists and community organizers who are attempting to mobilize the public to fight for certain goals? What is the role of community leaders, both official and unofficial? And how are all of those groups kind of circled around MPD to shape city politics? And the way that I started studying that, so I didn't, this isn't a project, and I tell this to my dissertation students because this book could have never been a dissertation book because it wasn't, I didn't have the idea for the project and then I had it perfectly designed and then I went out and implemented that design. It was really a series of separate projects. So the very first project I started was interviews with activists and organizers and people involved in the policing field. And another chunk of the research that we started back in 2017 was about interviewing neighborhood residents in North Minneapolis. Well, that project actually started because I had an undergraduate working with me under a McNair summer fellowship. And I said, I'm, working on this project on the politics of policing. What's interesting to you? And the student said, I really want to know how residents in the most impacted neighborhoods are making sense of this public attention on police violence. And that project, I had a number of students, all students of color, knocking on my door who were saying, I want to get involved. I want to feel like I'm doing sociology that contributes to this movement and that contributes to the goal of racial justice. And so that project wound up being a really big endeavor. We wound up interviewing more than 100 folks in North Minneapolis over 2 years of interviews. Two of the students who helped me conduct and analyze those interviews, Amber Joy Powell and Chris Robertson, wound up as co-authors on the article and then the book chapter that came out of those data. And that project, and so the interviews with activists and the interviews with residents, that was all wrapped up by 2019. And I have these strange papers to look back on now where I try really hard to make the case that we should care about Minneapolis. And Minneapolis is an interesting case study in the story of Black Lives Matter. And we were working on those papers. I thought the project was wrapped. I was moving on to other things when, of course, George Floyd was murdered as I was working just a couple miles away in South Minneapolis on this project. And so when that happened, it became really clear that Minneapolis was going to be this new emblem of sort of this new wave of BLM mobilization and efforts towards defunding and abolishing, transforming police departments. And so I launched back into data collection, but this time a lot of it was remote. We were, of course, in the middle of the kind of early phase of the pandemic. And so it was really about sort of tracing the political struggle of what happens in the wake to try and secure justice after that murder. And then at the very end of the project, I decided, okay, I have to go back in time. I have to trace the history of the police department. So I'm going to do a historical piece. Then at the even later in time, I thought, I can't just end with these efforts to secure justice. I really want to think about and sort of legal reforms. I really want to think about what's happening on the ground in terms of alternative models of public safety. And so then I did another wave of field work for thinking about some of these alternative models. So it really wasn't one project. It was a series of pretty disconnected projects, many of them collaborative with my students. And it was only relatively late in the process of drafting it that I really got a sense of like how all these pieces fit together for one through line.
Well, when I said the book is deeply researched, this is what I meant. Like all of these moments that build into a coherent picture of the history and development of policing in Minneapolis, then transitions in the city, itself transitions in the character of, policing and police practices, the union and the mayor being in control of it. Anyway, lots of things in the book. But one thing that really comes through is that reform ideas and abolition don't just spontaneously happen. They're the result of years and decades of work by activists. What had activists been requesting before Floyd's murder? And what were some of the key events that supported their framing of police violence as requiring police abolition?
Thank you for drawing out that thread. I mean, I think people sometimes in the kind of popular conversation, there's this idea, when BLM first emerges in 2014, it takes, 1 month for people to say, okay, and what came of that, right? What were the results? Now, what are the protesters demanding and did it work? And what is so clear when you look at any one city, really, in this case, Minneapolis, but I think it would be true anywhere, is that that's not how institutional change works, right? It takes a long time for movements to cohere and build the kind of bridges and solidarity that they need to cohere around a single set of ideas and a platform. It takes a long time for particularly city governments that are slow moving to implement these kinds of changes. And I think when we think about it in our daily lives, in any of the jobs that we are in, if we think about like, okay, I want to train, let's say, talk about officer training. I have nine at the time back in 2020, the MPD had about 900 officers. So I have 900 staff members. I need to figure out how to pick a training and then roll it out to 900 staff members and then think about how I evaluate that in their incredibly discretionary work day to day on the streets. That's a monumental task, right? Now, think about doing that times many, many types of reforms being demanded by many, many different types of groups, with this very diffuse power structure, right? Where nominally the mayor is in control of the police department. The police department also has significant political heft and is getting calls from city council members, getting calls from residents, getting calls from activists and organizers and community members, many of whom have competing demands on the institution. So change takes time. And, when we get, by the time we get to 2020 and the Powderhorn Declaration, where a subset of the city council members read this declaration where they promise to end the Minneapolis Police Department, that statement seems to come from this organizing that has lasted just weeks, right, in the wake of George Floyd's murder. But in fact, the language that the city council members are reading at that press conference is pulled verbatim from a 2017 report that had been put out by an abolitionist collective called the MPD 150. The report was released in 2017 on the anniversary of the MPD's 150th, their 150th anniversary. And it was sort of a abolitionist progress report on the police department. And that report itself, the reason that those organizers get to police abolition by 2017 and then continue to seed the ground until it sort of blooms in 2020 is that they had been working for years since the Ferguson Solidarity protests in 2014 to push the police department. And they were often pushing for what we'd understand as reformist initiatives. So things like training officers on how to interact politely and professionally with residents, training on implicit bias, training on de-escalation, changing policies around use of force and how use of force is documented, and officers' duty to intervene in use of force, misconduct policies, right? What happens when use of force is alleged to have been misconduct and how that gets reviewed. And there had continued to be a series of high-profile police killings, not just in Minneapolis, but in both neighboring jurisdictions and across the country, right? So one of the police killings that's really devastating to local organizers and residents is the death of Philando Castile, who was not killed by MPD officers, although that's a mistake people often make, but he was killed by officers that were contracted in a nearby suburb of St. Paul. But, this the Twin Cities is a small community that's very tight-knit. And there were these cases happening across the country. And one of the things I document in the book is that it's not enough for a police department to reform itself if the state troopers are committing police violence, if there's high-profile cases in other places in the country. All of that is cohering in people's minds as a sense of we've tried police reform and it's failed. And The activists, you know, that I talked to back in 2017, 2018, 2019 were very reflective about how they had sort of transformed their own thinking. And it was about sort of going onto the streets, protesting, demanding body camera footage get released, demanding there be investigations, demanding there being criminal trials, and seeing a lack of justice in so many of these cases over and over and over again that pushes them towards this more abolitionist model, right? We can't fix policing. Policing is inherently broken. It is inherently a tool of oppression, both class and race oppression. And so, therefore, the only answer is that we need to build, in the MPD report 150, MPD 150 report's language, we need to start building the police-free future that communities deserve. And groups like MPD 150 and Black Visions were working on the ground in the years that followed that 2017 report leading up to 2020. Reclaim the Block was another prominent local organization. The three of them were sort of tightly co-organized and had a lot of overlapping members. And all of them were working to start thinking about what it might mean to defund the police, including starting to call for the kinds of alternative public safety models that then blossom in the post-2020 period. So, for instance, one of the alternatives that I profile in the book is the Behavioral Crisis Response Team. They are a non-armed, mental health-oriented first responder, and their contract gets first developed in 2020. People are like, oh, well, this is a response to the murder of George Floyd. But in fact, that work had been going for years, right? And it was certainly, I think, sped along in the end by the kind of mass mobilization. But there's no way that they could have gotten all of that together in time had the groundwork not been laid for years. And the reason this important is important, it's not just like a question of history, right? Like, how do we understand this moment in 2020? But I think it's also when we think about what happened after 2020. So one of the questions I've gotten about the book is, why do you call it the Minneapolis Reckoning when nothing really changed, right? It wasn't the reckoning that wasn't, right? And are you kind of fueling this false narrative by calling the book the Minneapolis Reckoning? And part of my reaction to that is, first of all, that, you know, whether or not we see these kind of long-term changes that were demanded by residents and by activists and by city leaders, it was a moment of reckoning, right? In that moment, right? The fact that we saw the torching of a police precinct, the fact that we saw a veto-proof majority of a city council say that they were going to end a city's police department, right? Like, that was a profound moment that we need to really document and take seriously. But it's also true that I don't think we will really understand all of the impacts of that summer for years to come, right? And when I think about like the whole generation, a lot of my students, right, my undergraduate students who came of age during this period, right? I mean, I think there are so many ways that this movement is going to continue to have these longer term consequences, and we can't think about it in terms of months, or even necessarily years. And you know, in the chapters where I think about all of the outcomes of summer 2020, I was sort of writing up until the last moment when you know, the book was due. And there's a couple places in the book where I'm just like, I have to stop now, you know, at whatever point in 2023. But this is still very much an ongoing process, and I think that will continue to be the case.
I kept thinking about some of the things that I read in graduate school on social movements and social movement theory, and the whole idea that even though movements are sometimes punctuated with these dramatic events, often it is this years-long struggle and organization building, gathering the resources to continue even when it seems like nothing is happening, so that you're ready, you know, or that you're building incremental change or you're building capacity in your movement organization so that when something that I don't think we can call George Floyd's murder like exogenous necessarily, because it's certainly integrated into the history and development of the Minneapolis Police Department, which you document in the book quite well. But having those people and those organizations in place to recognize when opportunities develop and then seizing that moment, right? Having that report written in 2017 that lays out this pathway to significant police reform and changing policing practices just reminded me of some really good social movement work. So for those who are interested in policing and in movements and obviously race and racial injustice, Justice and Inequality. This book has lessons for you, I think.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I, it's funny when I was writing it, I kept sort of spinning in circles of like, is this a policing book? Is it a movements book? Is it a local politics book? You know, my training very much comes in the sort of tradition of the sociology of law and the sociology of punishment. I didn't come into this as a movement scholar, and I sort of learned the movements literature along the way because it was such a key part of the story. And even thinking about like, how did I get to the book cover? Like, the book cover was a whole story because what I said to the press was, I said, it's not a traditional policing book. Like, I don't want a picture of like a police car or an officer on the front of the book. It's also, though, not a straight movements book, right? Like, a picture of a movement protest, I think, would be a little bit misleading because it's not just about the movements piece. It's about the intersection. It's about the intersection with politics. And so I said, maybe we picture City Hall. And so that's the image that's on the book cover. That's actually Minneapolis's City Hall, although I don't know how many people will recognize the building. But that was in part in trying to think about, what kind of book is this and how do I want to frame it? And when I was thinking about what do I talk about in the conclusion and how much do I pitch this as lessons for movement scholars, where I came to in the end was that I really centered in the conclusion the sort of public audience that cares about public safety, because I felt like that was sort of my lane to be in the most squarely. But I also thought, I'm not actually sure what the lessons are for social movement scholars, in that I think movement scholars would have predicted a lot of this, right? Movement scholars know that most movements don't succeed overnight. Movement scholars know that it takes time and process. Movement scholars know that there's a lot of conflict within movements, and that that process of building solidarity across different factions of movements is such an important part of this story. And so what I hope to do is really just bridge together those conversations. And I think sometimes the movement scholars that have thought about BLM have thought about it in such the movements frame that they haven't had the nuances around sort of what is policing and why policing such a particular space. But I also think the criminologists have largely not thought about the social movements piece. And so it was fun, although there are some exceptions to that and some great early books on the BLM movement that folks should read. But it was important to me to put those in conversation together.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the end of the book and thinking about public safety, because to me, one of the core tensions that drives the argument and the lessons for this book is about the meaning of police for communities, particularly communities of color in Northside, Minneapolis, but other places too, about police as promising both state protection, but also bringing the threat of state violence. So we in sociology, I'll talk about communities being over-policed and under-protected. But in this case, it's over-policed, under-protected, and also subject to police violence. The divide between these two views and sometimes the inability to hold both of them at the same time make conflicts over policing very difficult to resolve or even productively engage. Is that right?
Yeah, so this book came out. It's a nice transition from our earlier conversation, because the book came out of me in part straddling these conversations, right? Like, straddling the conversation in sort of certain pockets of sociology that were very critical of policing and were developing towards at least a more abolitionist vision of sort of these are the, here's how policing enacts state violence and all of the really horrendous consequences of that state violence. And then straddling my other professional identity as a criminologist, where the literature is much more about community violence, the need to protect communities from violence, and the role that police play in preventing and responding to violence, which, just to sort of sidebar, is a very complicated literature, but there is some compelling evidence that certain police practices and certain police presence can meaningfully reduce certain kinds of harm in the community, right? Including homicides, but that they come at a cost, right? And that cost is police harassment, all of the negative consequences of people feeling like they're targeted by the police, including political consequences, social consequences, and all of the consequences of getting a criminal record, right? Which sociologists have been documenting for a long time now. And so I was trying to kind of bridge those two conversations in my head, and I was trying to make sense sense of how do you keep both of those in mind? And it was really the voices of community residents that pushed me to do that. I mean, I think one of the things that most surprised me when we were doing all of these interviews with Northside residents, was their insistence that their kind of complaint with political leaders, with organizers, and with university researchers was that there was this focus on police violence that wasn't paired with a focus on community violence, and that for people in the most impacted neighborhoods, those were experienced as two sides of the same coin, right? And equally problematic, but in different ways, and equally demanding of a holistic state response, right? And so they were really calling for this broader conversation to take violence seriously. And I think sociologists sometimes get nervous about taking violence seriously, right? There's this concern that if we think about, for instance, racial disparities in homicide rates, that that will inevitably kind of label or stigmatize certain groups and will fuel a narrative that criminalizes young Black men in urban spaces, in hyper particular, right? But as so many scholars have shown, going all the way back to Du Bois, right? We can think about racial differences in violence as also a product of state failure, right? As a product of racism and exclusion. So we don't have to shy away from violence. We just have to think about contextualizing violence, right? And so, on the one hand, to say communities are beset by both police violence and community violence, it's trite. It's banal. Like, of course we know that. And I wrestled with a bit, like, what does it mean for that to be the punchline line of the book? Like, are you not just stating the obvious here? But I think where it's helpful is that there's often this very reductionist discourse about the role of community violence in fueling police violence. And I want us to have a very different conversation about the reason that we have such trouble ever fully addressing police violence is that we have such high rates of community violence, and that those problems are both a consequence of racialized state failure and have to be addressed simultaneously. You will never succeed in fundamentally challenging police power if you don't have a compelling answer to what you do to disorder and victimization in the community. And scholars, especially in sociology, often sort of use this phrase, the police protect and serve some, but they victimize others. And that's absolutely true. And we can see that Danica Gordon has this great book, Policing the Racial Divide, that looks at policing in different kinds of districts within one city. That shows this beautifully. That's true. But it is also true that the communities that are most impacted by police violence are the same communities that are most beset by high rates of interpersonal violence and other kinds of community victimization. And so the two problems need to be thought about as part of the same conversation rather than separate conversations.
I appreciate your reference to James Forman Jr.'s book. I think it's called Policing Our Own, which
Locking up our own.
Locking Up Our Own, thank you. That's documenting how often Black communities who are beset with police violence and, racial injustice, economic injustice are the ones that are often calling for more police protection, even though they know that that protection or that policing often comes with the threat of violence for many vulnerable people in their communities. And so saying, yes, we have a police violence problem, and who's going to come when I have a crisis situation? If you can't give me an alternative, you can't tell me exactly what's going to happen, then I'm fearful, right? If you say, I don't know what we're going to replace the policing or the police function with, that goes directly to the challenges that someone who wants to offer abolition, police abolition as a response, you have to answer that question.
That's right. And I thought about Forman's book a lot as I was writing this. And I think about it as, in some ways, the kind of contemporary parallel, right? Because that book was mostly focused on a more historical period of the rise of mass incarceration using Washington, D.C. And it's a really interesting case study, is his argument. The reason it's called Locking Up Our Own, right? Is that he's thinking about in a city in which the political elite, the judges, even the police officers, right? We have a lot of racial representation of the Black community in those positions of authority. And yet we still developed mass incarceration in DC and the policies that fueled mass incarceration. So why would we lock up our own? And so what was interesting to me about thinking about that framework in the context of Minneapolis, which is still a majority white city, was to think about what happens in these kind of liberal spaces where white city leaders are promising to listen to Black voices, but there is no one voice, right? There is this really complicated set of voices who are calling for a complicated set of things. And I think sometimes that conversation gets reduced in this like clickbaity kind of way of like Black communities want more cops. And I don't think that's right. And I think that that is unhelpful for us to continue to say, just as it is unhelpful for people to continue to say, oh, well, abolition is driven by white activists who've never touched crime. There are elements of truth in both of those stories, but neither of them tells the whole story because both sets of racial groups and communities are really heterogeneous, right? No community has one single voice. And the difference is that for Black residents, these problems are intimate and personal in a way that it is really rare to see for white residents, right? It feels like a life and death issue because it is a life and death issue for Black communities, whereas it feels a much more abstract intellectual problem for white residents. But that matters because when we're thinking about what is the story here, the story is not Black communities want more policing. The story is that Black communities want more protection, particularly low-income communities of color, right? They want more protection, that we shouldn't think of protection as synonymous with policing.
Policing.
And that we need to think about like what policing does, right? So it does offer less of this threat of violence.
Yeah. Okay. That's really great. So listeners may have heard or may need to be reminded that Minneapolis was considering defunding the police after this declaration in the park, the Powderhorn Declaration. Minneapolis was considering defunding the police, but a charter amendment to restructure public safety services in the city ultimately failed. So before we talk about maybe why it failed or what the dynamics were there, what was the measure actually intending to do?
So if we go back to summer 2020 and we think about those council members that were on the stage at Powderhorn Park, what they promised to do was to begin the process of ending the MPD, which was language that would be scrutinized across the political spectrum, right? What does it mean to begin the process of ending a police department? And what became apparent very quickly was that all of those city council members, even among the city council members who were standing on the stage, they had different ideas about what it would mean to begin the end of the MPD, with some of them thinking more along a kind of transformational reform that would include the input of the police chief, who at the time was our first Black police chief and was beloved by many community members, and a wing of the group that was much more aligned explicitly with the abolitionist organizers who had precipitated the event. And what became clear very quickly was that procedurally, the only way for them to, so the Minneapolis has what's called a city charter. The city charter outlines a series of kind of governing rules, including mandatory city departments. The MPD is one of those city departments that is written into the city charter. And because of a victory of the police officers union back in the 1960s, not only was the MPD written into the city charter, but a guaranteed minimum number of officers per capita was written into the city's organizing documents. And in order to change the city charter, you needed to go through one of two routes. If you had everybody on council say yes to a proposal and the mayor, you could do it that way. If you couldn't get everybody on board, you would have to do it through a popular vote. It would have to go on the ballot. And so from the get-go, it's very clear that the mayor won't support this initiative to end the MPD. And so they're going to have to go the ballot initiative to trying to get onto the 2020 ballot proved difficult. There wasn't the long technical story, but essentially there's a review board that gets to review charter amendments, and they ran out the clock to prevent it from getting on the ballot in 2020 when it would have been more immediate and it would have been a presidential election. So we did have higher turnout. So it finally gets up for a vote in November 2021 after being blocked in 2020. And what actually gets on the ballot for that vote is an initiative that would revise the Minneapolis City Charter. So all of the text in the city charter on the MPD, which included the language about the mandatory minimum number of officers that the union had won in the decades prior, language about the mayor having exclusive executive control over the police department, because of course the city council was trying to wrest power from the mayor. All of that language would be struck, and in its place would be a new department called the Department of Public Safety that would be oriented around a public health approach to public safety. And that included the language that law enforcement could be included as a division of this new department if deemed necessary. And so that language, if necessary becomes really contested and controversial. But the idea was that what we now think of as the MPD would essentially be a unit underneath this new Department of Public Safety that would also include these alternative public safety approaches, including things like violence interruption, including things like what becomes the unarmed mental health and behavioral health crisis response. All of that would be housed under a Department of Public Safety that would be directed now by the City Council and the mayor, because the mayor would no longer have this exclusive executive authority. Although, sidebar, there was a separate charter amendment that wanted to give the mayor that kind of power over all city departments. So, if that question had passed and it did pass, then this shifting of power would have been nulled out by that other charter amendment question. But it would have struck out the mayor's executive control, except for this other charter amendment, and it would have struck out the mandatory minimum number of officers. So, it was talked about in the press as a defund initiative. And, you know, I think there's good reason for that. When the city council members took to the stage at Powderhorn Park, it was emblazoned, right, with the words defund police. It was really understood as a defund initiative. But there actually was nothing in the thing that people actually voted on procedurally that said anything about defunding. What it did was it would have allowed for significant destaffing that would have corresponded with defunding, right? Although, ironically, like what we have now actually is a public safety department. We do now have a department. It's called the Office of Community Safety, I believe. There was a couple of different name changes and they all kind of sound the same. But we do have a new department and the MPD is housed underneath it. But we still have in the city's charter this mandatory minimum number of officers. We're actually still below that number because the department has struggled so much to hire and retain officers, even though we're spending more than we've ever spent on the police department in recent history. So defunding and staffing may not always correlate, but the structure of the charter amendment was built so that you could substantially reduce the number of law enforcement and increase the number of other kinds of responders. But it didn't mandate that. It just changed the political constraints. But everything would be on the line depending on who was mayor, who was on city council, what happened with that other ballot initiative about exclusive mayoral control over the other city departments. And so it would have shifted the terrain of politics rather than demanding the city defund the police.
I learned so much about this charter amendment and the machinations of getting it on the ballot. And of course, like even the idea of a public health model for community safety is a contested one. I mean, you can imagine people saying, well, the police are part of the public health safety apparatus because they show up when there's a threat to public safety or to the public's health. Anyway, I think, you know, all of these terms can be or and are really, really contested.
Right.
Okay, so
And
Election
just as
Day
a
comes.
sort of funny
Go
aside
ahead.
on that, I mean, I think one of the things that was a little perplexing to me was that so the name of this new department shifted between the 2020 initiative and the 2021 initiative. And by 2021, this language of public safety, so it would have been the Department of Public Safety, was what was proposed, DPS. That language of public safety had come to signal to people this idea of a more sort of robust or holistic approach to public safety. And so people would say, you know, on Twitter and other spaces, like, oh, well, we already have, you know, at the state level and other spaces, departments and offices of public safety. And that was true, but those departments and units were almost always exclusively staffed by law enforcement. Like it was just another word for law enforcement. And so I think it highlights like this idea of like, what is safety, right? What is the role of the police? What, when you say violence, what kind of violence are people talking about? All of these terms were deeply contested. And part of what movement actors were trying to do was to redefine them, right? And so public safety, this idea of transforming public safety or reimagining public safety is the banner we've kind of collectively decided these efforts fit under, but it's not natural or obvious that that's what that language would come to mean.
I've never seen a police officer roll up at a scene of structural violence or systemic and institutional racism, right?
Well, except they do every day, but yes, they wouldn't call it that.
Yeah, right. They don't show up to arrest the maybe the perpetrators
Right.
of that. Okay. Election day arrives, and as we have mentioned, the charter amendment fails, and the other ballot initiative giving the mayor more power is actually approved. And so what comes out of this is a restructuring of the public safety system, even if that's not what was on the ballot. But what's super interesting is maybe people are thinking that it was mostly the Black residents that voted for the charter amendment, and it was mostly, you know, white residents or wealthier white residents that voted against the charter amendment. But your research actually finds there was more of an age divide than a race divide. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so we started this conversation by talking about like what were all the different pieces of data collection and how did they come into the project? And the way that I structured the book was really as all of the interviews that I had conducted with residents and activists become kind of the preamble to why we see the aftermath of George Floyd's murder play out in all of the ways, all of the complicated, beautiful, tragic ways that it plays out in the like 3 year window essentially that follows. And so one of the through lines from those early chapters is about, so we had focused on North Minneapolis to do those resident interviews. North Minneapolis, for folks who don't know, is the part of Minneapolis that has the highest number of Black residents. It has the highest concentrated poverty. It has the highest rates of homicides in the city. And it is where a number of the police killings of Black men in Minneapolis happened. In fact, it was a little bit of an outlier that George Floyd was murdered in South Minneapolis. And I think one of the underappreciated stories of why we get this mass mobilization is actually that I don't think you would have had as many white residents mobilize in the way that they did if it had been in North Minneapolis. But because it was in this more multiracial neighborhood, I think you saw in part a different spot. I think that case is different for lots of reasons, but I think the spatial analysis was part of it too. So North Minneapolis, we can think about as being, and North Minneapolis is a large and diverse space with lots of different individual neighborhoods. But in general, we can think about North Minneapolis as having the pockets of the city that have the most stark racialized inequality. And so that was where we focused our interviews, and focusing in particular on interviews with Black residents, as I'd said earlier, like one of the more surprising at the time findings to me was how much people wanted to talk to us about crime and violence and disorder and how that tempered how they were thinking about these calls to address police violence. And, you know, we started those interviews very deliberately asking about exposure to violence. And the reason I did that was because we wanted to think about sort of when do people think about calling in the police? And before we prompt them to think about the police, I wanted to prompt them to think about the kinds of situations that might lead to police involvement and whether they involve police or not. But I'm actually really glad we started the interviews that way because people told us in really gut-wrenching detail about, you know, there are holes in my headboard and I hear gunshots at night. Somebody was murdered on my block. And get into how that was shaping people's everyday lives and the way they navigated this space. And so by the time the Charter Amendment comes up, the whole public conversation in Minneapolis is about whether or not Black residents support the Charter Amendment. Like there is widespread agreement among city leaders and among many city residents, including the majority white city residents, that how this question should be decided is about how Black residents who are most exposed to both police and community violence think about the Charter Amendment. And the problem was that that actually wasn't clear to people, right? And so you had all these press stories that would find, you know, Black community leaders who would say the most negative things about the Charter Amendment. Then you would have other press, often in more left-leaning spaces, highlighting the Black activists who were leading the charge for these initiatives and the voices of residents talking about police violence and why we needed to do something different. So everybody agreed on the terms of the debate being about what would make Black residents feel safer in the city, but the answer to what would make people feel safer diverged, and people had those diverging frameworks, not because they were fabricating it out of thin air, but because this bind between community violence and police violence really divided Northsiders and Black residents in general in the city and the state on this question of the Charter Amendment. And the Charter Amendment, as we just talked about, it was such a in the weeds processy kind of shift that it was really hard for organizers to describe what would actually happen. Even something as simple as how many police will we have after this charter amendment passes, if it passes, nobody could answer that question. And so there were these promises about we'll have more holistic response and you'll still have police officers respond if you need a police officer. But at the same time, everybody knew that this had been led by abolitionist activists who very much wanted to have a police-free future. Like that was not hidden. And in fact, that was an important part of the coalition for it was question two on the ballot. And so you had this divide of like, what would this charter initiative actually do? And at the same time, you had the chief of police, who, as I said, was our first Black police chief officer, raised in the Twin Cities and beloved to many in the community, who had done a lot to further the efforts towards police reform and addressing racial bias in policing. And you had him and the officers' rank and file and the union all stating quite loudly that chief, in fact, wrote an op-ed for the Star Tribune saying that this situation of reporting to a non-law enforcement division chief would be intolerable to any law enforcement. So we were already at a moment, you know, this is the pandemic in 2020 and 2021. A lot of cities saw a spike in homicides. That was particularly true in Minneapolis. And we were hemorrhaging officers as people abandoned the department and got jobs in other kinds of law enforcement agencies across the state that weren't as embittered. And we were under, there was a lawsuit going to try and increase the number of officers because it was below that mandatory number minimum. So there were all of these moving parts going on, and residents were scared that if the charter amendment passed, would that lead to even more instability in emergency response? And, you know, the truth is, I mean, I think a lot of advocates for the charter amendment kind of poo-pooed that as fear-mongering, but I don't think people were wrong. I think in the short term, that had the charter amendment passed, it probably would have led to a lot of instability because the way that it was set up, all of the planning of how this would actually look like on the ground couldn't happen until after it passed. So, by definition, there was going to be a lot of instability. It might have been a great thing in the end, but it would have entailed a period of instability. It would have been Northside that paid the price for that period of instability. And so, when people talk about the Charter Amendment, I mean, first of all, it's talked about as a failure, but the fact that 44% voted yes on initiative in an off-election cycle that was understood to be an abolitionist proposal, I mean, that is a kind of wild success. And we did, in the end, get this holistic public safety department. It was a late-breaking campaign promise of Mayor Fry as polls were showing the popularity of question two. So I think the fact that it got so much support is meaningful. I think the fact that we still did a lot of this work is meaningful. And I think the fact that it didn't get support, and it didn't get support, right, to come back to the spatial pattern question, it didn't get support in North Minneapolis. It wasn't because people love the MPD. It was this ambivalent reliance, right? A reliance with a lot of hesitation, reliance on police with a lot of mistrust. And I think that's what people get wrong when they talk about, you know, Black communities want more policing. They don't. They want more protection, and they want policing that treats them like human. And the question of the Charter Amendment came down to, do you believe a more just future is possible under this set of arrangements or this set of arrangements? And both seemed really utopian in some ways, right? Like the idea of police reform is utopian, but the idea that we'd build a new department from scratch felt utopian as well. And so people were really conflicted more than opposed to it. And I, you know, the other thing we learned from those spatial maps is that the precincts that voted most strongly in favor of the Charter Amendment were the ones with younger voters, as you noted, and the precincts that were around George Floyd Square, right, that were sort of most impacted and most central to those efforts to find justice for George. The precincts, so North Minneapolis did on average vote no, although voter turnout was very low. Again, this wasn't a presidential election year. Voter turnout was highest and opposition was staunchest in the southwest pocket of the city, which is the wealthiest and whitest pocket of the city. So there is some credence to this story of white elite residents were a strong part of the opposition to the Charter Amendment. That's just not the whole story. And when we look at, so the Star Tribune and some of their media partners did a poll of registered voters about a month before the election. And what they found actually was that there was very little difference on average between Black residents and white residents on how they were going to vote on the Charter Amendment. But there was a really stark divide across age, right? So it was a generational divide. We see that in the precinct results too, rather than a racial divide. But again, I don't think that's not because Black and white residents didn't think about these issues differently, but it was where did they come down on this particular question, which was such a complicated intervention in this whole political ecosphere around policing.
I think it's a fascinating part of the story and the meaning of safety and the desire for safety, which is a reasonable desire, and people should have safety in their communities, particularly ones that are most beset by these problems. I want to turn a little bit and talk about, again, the problem of of police violence and some of the things that have been done in terms of policy to reduce the inequitable and racialized policing that we've seen, including police violence, lethal and non-lethal. So on page 156, you write, policy reforms were, again, not enough. The reforms were marred by a crushingly steady rate of police killings, as well as routine surveillance and harassment of communities of color. They failed in part because there was no one theory of what exactly was driving police violence in this city, or what kind of police violence should be the focus of reform and what to do about it. End quote. So sociologists might fall back on larger social and structural issues, and of course, they would be right. But what did you identify as some specific barriers to reducing both lethal and non-lethal police violence in this case?
Yeah, so you can think about this in a couple of different buckets. You can think about what are the barriers to just reducing those levels or reducing the disparities, and then you can think about what would it take to actually eliminate them, and how would we know? Like, how would we measure that in a very technical sense? So on the first level, sort of how do we reduce these things and why do we see such barriers? In that sentence that you quote, when I say the reforms were again not enough, what I'm referencing is an earlier chapter in the book that looked at the early BLM year reform efforts in the MPD, things like, training on implicit bias and procedural justice, changes around policies. There was a sanctity of life policy that attempted to enshrine in policy this goal of de-escalation and preserving life among community members. There were, efforts to reform how misconduct was evaluated and reviewed. And largely, while the department did roll out an extensive set of training for its officers, which showed some modest improvements in officers' perceptions of the importance, for instance, of treating the public fairly, and some modest improvements actually in resident surveys. So the Urban Institute was doing an evaluation of this initiative. It was called the National Initiatives. And they found some small improvements in resident satisfaction with perceptions of policing action, and particularly kind of bias in these procedural justice indicators, right? Did officers treat you fairly? Did they give you voice? Did they seem neutral in their decision making? They were these really small incremental reforms, right? And what you see in the post-2020 period is the department kind of rediscovers those reforms and attempts to sort of do them again, but a little bit more, right? And they face a lot of the same barriers they did in the early years. And those barriers included an entrenched culture among officers of a sort of protect yourself first against violence. Sociologist Michael Sierra Arevalo has a great new book called The Danger Imperative that is all about how this kind of focus on officer safety gets baked into officers' training and daily operations. But that kind of culture is very pervasive in the MPD. They had an extremely strong union, and a lot of the kind of disciplinary mechanisms were part of the union contract negotiation. So there were pieces of this that the city couldn't do, and there are pieces of this that the city could do and that the union fought back on. So the kind of funniest one from the early period is that after the police killing of Justine Damond in 2017, the advocates organized around Justice for Justine pushed the city to end this quote-unquote fear-based training that police officers were taking and the city was paying for, and that the officer who had shot and killed Justine had taken before the fatal incident. And so they push on the city, they push on the city. The mayor says, yes, we're going to ban this fear-based training for officers. And immediately the union says, oh, we'll just pay for officers to go if they want to go, right? And became kind of heroes for a moment on internet sites for police officers and their unions. So they were facing officer resistance, they were facing union resistance. They're also facing union protections that are baked into state law. They're also facing state laws that give officers a lot of leeway in when they determine whether or not they can use lethal force. So part of the issue has been, activists had often called for criminal cases. Well, it's really hard to prosecute a criminal case against an officer. The law gives them a lot of discretion to use lethal force. And juries, and to some extent, this is sort of changing in some places, prosecutors have been really hesitant to initiate those cases and to find officers guilty. And so all of that makes the kind of procedural incremental judicial reforms really difficult, right? We were limited in who we can hire as officers. Officers shape their daily practices. The union has a lot of power in shaping disciplinary processes. The criminal track is largely blocked. And so that's why it's so hard to kind of make these directions. You can make them, and departments have made them, but it takes a huge amount of sustained attention and political capital, and frankly, money, right? It takes a lot of money to roll out these kind of incremental reforms that at best can make these kind of small changes. When the Minnesota Department of Human Rights comes in and investigates the MPD in the wake of George Floyd's murder, the report that they ultimately put out argues that the department engages in what they call race-based policing, right? They document these racial inequities. They document, too, that many of those racial inequities are not driven by the behavior of the people who are interacting with police, that we see inequities persist even if we control for those kind of mediating differences. And they call that race-based policing. And they're currently working with the city under a consent decree to try and create what they call impartial and fair and constitutional policing. But it's hard to imagine, no matter how good those reforms get, no matter how much money and time and political heft they invest in them, it's hard to imagine, given the racialized inequities in our cities, it's hard to imagine that we will ever get to a place where we wouldn't call policing race-based policing, right? Or understand it as race-based policing. I mean, race is baked into where people live. It is baked into employment opportunities. It is baked into environmental conditions. It is baked into the schools, right? How in the world would we not see that pop up in policing, right? And I think that was really the blessing of the abolitionist organizing in 2020, was to start a more robust conversation about that, right? Like, how, instead of just thinking about, oh, well, if we control away all of those pre-existing conditions, how do we get rid of the bias that remains? How do we think about how do we actually address all of that pre-existing inequity? And frankly, this is where I'm sort of disappointed that we don't see more police chiefs come out front and center on, because police, in many respects, if you can talk to them about it in the right language, police, and particularly police leadership, but also rank and file, they see this, right? They see it on the streets. They see it in the calls that they take, and they don't want to be at the site of structural racism day in, day out. The things that they see, right, they give them nightmares and PTSD. They see horrific things happen up close, and they see that because of all the inequity in our society. And so instead of constantly arguing for more and more police resources, I would love to see a sort of more sociological vision of inequality take root, and to think about, how can police help us to identify all of those places where other systems are failing? David Thatcher calls this the monitoring role of the police, that they can monitor for other institutional failures. And the answer isn't to expand their jurisdiction, but to sort of have that push us to identify those other failures and create solutions for them.
I kept thinking about, in my area of sociology and medicine, fundamental cause theory, right? We see differences in racialized groups in certain chronic conditions, not because Black Americans are just predisposed to diabetes and hypertension, but that our society deals out those conditions on the basis of other inequities, wealth, income, education, healthful neighborhoods, those sorts of factors. And then at the same time, there's a connection between those structural issues and the way organizations operate in racially unjust ways. So, like, Victor Wray's racialized organization, like the Minneapolis Police Department, I think it's fair to say, is a racialized
Racialized
organization,
organization.
for a variety of reasons, one of which being the fact that officers no longer have to live in the city that they practice in. And so what you have is a police department that officers who often are disconnected from the communities that they operate within, right? They're living very different lives than the people in communities that they're called to police on a regular basis.
Yeah. And, the medical parallel is interesting. I got a question at a talk recently. Shouldn't we think about the failure of police? Like, it reminds me of blaming ER doctors that so many people die in the ER, right? And I thought, no, like that actually is, I think, a useful parallel, right? Like this, and it's partly why I think police should be, and police leadership in particular, can gain a lot from explicitly engaging with a more sociological perspective, is it's wild that when crime goes up, the public answer is, what are the police doing about it? And not, what what is everybody doing about it, right? Like, this is one agency that at best can make these really small improvements in safety, right? But there's a reason that wealthy neighborhoods don't have a lot of police petroleum. Now, okay, some that metaphor breaks down a little bit because, like, hyper wealthy neighborhoods often have sort of security gates and private security, and they're in fact heavily policed to keep out. But if we think about, sort of a functioning upper middle class neighborhood, what makes that neighborhood a nice place to live, what makes that neighborhood a healthy place to live, is that most of the people living there have enough of what they need to get access to schooling and education and have the kind of material well-being and social status that allows them to largely sidestep these kinds of behaviors and patterns that we then criminalize, right? And that we see in deeply impoverished neighborhoods and higher rates. So, like, the answer is staring at us right there in the face. But instead, the public reaction is always like, where are the police? Why didn't the police solve this? But they are the last stage in a very long process of failure.
All right, well, I want to move to your chapter six, which covers violence interruption and prevention efforts through three main mechanisms. So the first, community violence prevention groups, and then second, mobile behavioral response units, which you mentioned already. And then third, an independently funded abolition hotline. So these were mostly pilots and funded on shoestring budgets. Yet you write on page 174, these experiments and new approaches to community safety carried the weight of a traumatized city. So, in addition to funding or beyond funding, what other challenges did these initiatives face?
They face so many challenges. And, in some ways, it's interesting because part of what I learned from doing the chapter where I went back in time to think about the history of the MPD is that we can think about the history of some of these alternative public safety models as paralleling some of the challenges of early policing, right? Like, it took a long time to figure out who would we hire for police? What was the scope of their role? How would they be trained? What would they wear, right? Just the procurement process for getting the like t-shirts and jackets for all of these alternative stuff. Like, that took months and months and months and involved like incredibly complicated contract negotiations to get like sweatshirts, right? So, like, really basic things. And that was true for the police too. This sort of struggle over, will police wear standardized uniforms and what will they look like was what we see play out again in these kind of early groups. We also see questions that, again, are very similar to the questions about policing, right? What is the accountability mechanisms when these alternative first responders and alternative public safety workers commit harm in the community? What is their scope of practice? And, in this chapter, I would say it's not fair to say that those are sort of the three models I profile are not the only things that were happening in the city, but they were sort of three case studies that I thought usefully illustrated some of these tensions. And some of them were more top-down driven, like city initiatives, and some of them were very much bottom-up attempts to kind of sidestep the city initiatives. So to take the case of the violence interrupters, for instance, the way the city went about this was to put funding that they would then give out as contracts to community groups that had already been doing this violence prevention work. So violence prevention, just as kind of a primer, is a public health model that tries to interrupt the cycle of violence by sending out street workers who are often formerly justice-involved people, often men in their 30s and 40s, who then try to do essentially casework with the young people who are most likely to be both the perpetrators and the victims of violent crime. So they connect them to services, they can serve as mentors, they can, in some cases, bring those young men into the initiatives themselves as street workers, and they can attempt to sort of broker truces between different young men or different groups when violence is starting to heat up, and to serve as a buffer between the young men and the community and the young men and the police and the young men and other groups of young men. So those groups had been doing this work often on a volunteer basis, sometimes for years, sometimes they were newer groups, and were now suddenly getting city funding. So there were all of these questions like, will you all wear the same t-shirt so people can recognize you as part of the city-funded initiatives and not all of these many different organizations? The groups were really opposed to that initially, right? Because they had sort of branded themselves as their own style of intervention that was known in the community. And the whole goal of violence interruption is that you get people who have power and leverage in the community because they're known and respected and they understand the local context. So what does it mean to try and create a city-run centralized system of hyper-local street interventionists who are very much doing their own thing, right? And those groups, I should note too, had really different and divergent politics and relationships and understandings of sort of their role vis-a-vis the police, right? And so the idea of getting all those groups to work together was a challenge, right? And let alone branding them under kind of one city initiative and then directing them to do targeted outreach in certain times and certain places. There were also questions about how are these people trained and overseen? So there was a community organization that wound up suing the city to try and get access to what are the training standards? What are the accountability mechanisms? And this bubbled up in particular when one of these groups was contracted by a local grocery store to provide. So the MPD, before 2020, the MPD would do a lot of off-duty security work. And in fact, the city had policies in place that made it so that businesses were supposed to use the MPD off-duty officers as that security. And they changed that post-2020. So you see a lot of these programs being hired to do security at grocery stores. There's a group that winds up doing armed security at funerals to prevent retaliatory violence at funerals. But one of these violence interruption workers who gets hired at a grocery store winds up getting caught on tape beating up somebody who was panhandling outside the store, right? And so all these questions emerge. Like, if you see a violence interrupter doing harm in the community, who do you report it to? Who investigates that, right? And in this case, the person was swiftly fired and they weren't carrying a gun. So I don't want to create a false equivalency here that like these groups are facing all the same challenges as police or all of the same risks of harm to the community because it looks different when they're not carrying a weapon, which most, though not all of the violence prevention groups did not carry weapons, and that none of the ones funded by the city did. But there were still these questions about accountability. And more broadly, you know, if we go back to our conversation about fundamental cause theory and broad social inequalities, these kind of alternative approaches are, I think, best understood not as an alternative to policing, not even understood as a like solution to police violence, which I think they will fail at if we set them up for doing that. And I can come back to that later if we want to talk about it. But I think how we should understand them is as creating different answers to the problem of criminalizing poverty so that we're not always sending in police as our like frontline responders. But it is likely that these alternative models are going to bump up against the same barrier. So, you know, to pop over to the behavioral crisis folks, if they don't have housing opportunities to place people, if they don't have treatment opportunities that are culturally responsive and respectful and effective for people, they can intervene in that moment of crisis and I think can and do provide a better response in that moment. But none of these kind of initiatives are going to be able to solve the broader structural inequalities without much broader scale interventions.
I've been waffling back and forth between mentioning the fact that you quite rightly argue that police are actually cheap. I mean, even though there are a lot of arguments that
It's controversial.
we should defund the police, you know, because they're making so, it's not necessarily particular officer salaries, although that's an issue. It's more that a decent portion of city budgets are in fact spent on policing, and that gets into tax rates and tax policy and things like that, how we fund our public services. But because police come at the end of this very inequitable social and structural conditions, deploying this force is actually much less expensive than it would be compared to ensuring that everyone has adequate housing and healthcare coverage and a decent education and a healthful environment in which to live. Really, the things that you would have to do if you wanted to, again, tackle kind of the fundamental causes of crime in our society. I did want you to mention, though, the abolition hotline. Tell us what that is, because I was very intrigued.
Yeah, so there's a group of organizers in Minneapolis who began this group. They go by the acronym REP or REP, and REP actually has a couple of different meanings, but one of them is Revolutionary Emergency Partners. And what they were trying to do with that hotline is to think about how can we get community care dispatched to people without going through city government. So the way that they did that was to set up their own hotline and to build a program from scratch. and to train both call takers and folks that they called carers who would go out into the community all across the Twin Cities and respond to these calls for assistance. Now, that was only a small portion of what this group was doing. They were also doing a lot of community building in what they called pods or kind of networked groups to try and increase community capacity so that instead of calling a hotline, people would be able to rely on their neighbors. They were doing bystander intervention trainings. They're doing a lot of other things, but the hotline itself was really meant as a what could we imagine as community-led safety that had nothing to do with calling 911. So one of the limits of the BCR team that I mentioned is that the way that they get dispatched is through 911. Now that's a great strength. Like people know to call 911. There's like an infrastructure there. They are taking thousands of calls. The volume is very high. They've taken something like 16,000 calls since they opened in late 2021. But it also means you have to call 911. And it means if the BCR is not available or if they show up and deem a police response necessary, which is infrequent, but it happens, that police could be called. And the idea of this alternative emergency support line was that the caller would, because it operated outside of city government, the caller would always be in control of whether or not the police were called, right? That it would be a deference to that person and their demands in the moment. Now, the limit, of course, of that was the scale is very small. They're like operating this, you know, Friday and Saturday nights, most weeks, but not all weeks. They take pauses. And as, you know, the organizers behind the initiative will tell you, like, it's not meant to replace 911. It's meant to expand our imagination of like what constitutes an emergency that we need a state response that could include law enforcement. And how is it that we can show up for one another? And like the BCR, they don't take any calls that involve sort of an active threat of violence, which is sort of the territory most likely to be ceded to police and all of these kind of alternative models. But the idea is to demonstrate, you know, if the idea of BCR is to demonstrate you can have a more responsive model that sends in professional counselors and crisis coordinators to some of what prompts 911 calls, the goal of REP is to show that there are lots of situations where people are sort of primed to call 911, where you could instead rely on community. Community, right? So, what would it mean to better know the people on your block? What would it mean to have a safety plan where if you thought there was an imminent kind of concern, or really, because the concern about violence gets kind of into more murky territory. But let's say your neighbor is blasting loud music at 2 in the morning, right? Like, why is so many Americans' initial response that I need to call armed law enforcement to show up to what is a noise disturbance complaint between two residents, right? So, like, how do we think about how we form stronger bonds of community? So, like, maybe you don't feel safe. Maybe you are vulnerable for whatever reason, or you just don't feel secure in that moment going to the door. Can you think about who in the neighborhood could go with you so you would feel more secure knocking on that person's door? Or can you make connections to that neighbor in not a moment of tension and crisis so that you're not so nervous to go knock on the door, right? Like, that's the kind of big picture idea is like, how do we rethink what constitutes a crisis and how do we create networks of care that allow people to kind of show up for one another? Now, sociologists will always say, like, there is a limit to mutual aid, right? Like, you are not going to solve racialized inequality with mutual aid. And I wouldn't disagree with that. But I do think there's a lot of space for people to kind of rediscover that kind of local sense of community and to think more deeply about what that means vis-a-vis when they feel safe and what safety means to them and when they invoke state response.
Right. I think following up on that, you mentioned one of my favorite authors and texts a couple of times in the book. And there's an undercurrent, I think, in the book with Robin DG Kelly's idea, Freedom Dreams, and their book with that same title, and really about the radical emancipatory imagination. That's what Freedom Dreams is about. So could you say something about how the ideas and actions towards freedom, and especially the Black freedom struggle, might inform your work?
Yeah, thank you. That's such a good transition to this question because I think it gets at the very heart of it, which is that the reason I end this chapter, the book, with this chapter on these alternative public safety models. So that chapter, when I submitted the initial book proposal, that chapter was not included in the book proposal. castle. It really ended with sort of how do we understand all the aftermath of George Floyd's murder? And that whole two chapters was supposed to be one chapter. The back half of the book really just like as I wrote got longer and longer and longer. But the reason I end with those is because I do think it's really important that people not take away that the story of the Minneapolis and the story of the Charter Amendment was one of failure. I mean, I think it's a complicated story, but part of it is that radical imaginations about alternative models of safety are not only possible, but are already happening, right? Are already taking root. And I think we need to be, cautious and thoughtful about not overpromising what those new models can do or are already doing. But I think we need to acknowledge that they're there. We need to, in some ways, take the win, right? That like good things are happening, right? They're happening alongside a lot of crap, but they're seeds, right? Just like all of those earlier efforts towards thinking about police defunding and a police-free future, it was very unclear where that was all going in 2017, right? But 2020, we see this profound moment of visibility. I think the same is true now, right? We're seeding the ground for thinking about how many 911 calls need to happen in the first place, how many of those calls need to get dispatched to law enforcement, what do those different responders look like? And all of that is because activists did this radical imagination, right? And in a move towards liberation, they freedom dreamed. And I don't think it's any mistake. I was going back to Kelly's book as I was writing that section of the book. And in Freedom Dreams from 2002, although it was recently re-released, he has a chapter on Black feminism, right? And identifies Black feminist as having the most radical freedom dreams. And I think it's no mistake that BLM was undergirded. And we think about BLM as sort of this masculinist movement because the high-profile cases of police violence that are highlighted were often, although not exclusively, but often men who are killed by law enforcement. But it was driven by women activists, right? And it was driven by women activists who were drawing on this long tradition of Black radical feminism, right? Deva Woodley talks about this in her book Reckoning, which I super recommend. Like that history and all of the movement organizing towards prison abolition in the earlier decades, like that's what seeds the ground for this movement towards police abolition. And it's funny, reviewer two actually on the book manuscript, one of their comments was to reduce how much I talked about freedom dreaming in the introduction to the book, because the argument, which I did actually, a lot of that got moved to the chapter on activists. And their argument was, you don't want to set this up as if it were like a straight movements and Black radicalism book, because it's not. Like it's a politics and policing book, and you don't want to overpromise and underdeliver. And that's true. And where I engage with Freedom Dreams most explicitly is on that chapter on the sort of evolution of the local activist scene. And so that's where I moved a lot of that material. But it is a through line throughout the book. But I wanted to be careful. I am, doing this work as a white scholar, and I wanted to be thoughtful too of my own positionality. I was not trained in the Black radical tradition, and I didn't want to kind of overclaim that mantle. But I find that work deeply inspiring and really important and powerful for understanding policing. And part of the goal of the book is to kind of, again, not just bring the social movements literature, but to bring that Black radical tradition in conversation with a criminological literature that absolutely does not talk in that language, right? And in fact, there was just a Twitter storm because a prominent criminology scholar criticized a talk from a Black junior scholar for using this language of liberation, right? And sort of mocking that language. And I think that's exactly the problem, is like that those conversations are happening in separate tracks, and it's so important to bring them together.
All right. Well, I think that's a nice place to pause the discussion about your book, because I'm going to be thinking about it for a long time, even in the absence of this particular conversation, and maybe move to our banter segment. So it is April, as T.S. Eliot said, the cruelest month. And a cruel month for many academics. Lots of things to grade and classes to teach and final exam angst to deal with. But in our preparation for this, we were talking about summer plans. And earlier I shared that we in our household are usually in a mad dash for summer camp activities for our kiddo. But what I wanted to ask you about is insufferable academics when asked about taking time off during the summers.
Yeah, well, just to back up to the Coolest month. I mean, I live in Minnesota, obviously, and so my first thought was the weather. Usually, April is the cruelest month, March too, but also April because like winter has just gone on for so long at that point. And my husband actually, I think I can share this on a podcast. My husband has a late March birthday that he has officially for years now rescheduled to May because March is always the worst, which creates a lot of conflict in his family about when they're supposed to call for his birthday and confusion from our kids about when daddy's birthday is. But yeah, this has been a weird winter though, because in Minnesota, we barely got any snow. It's been sort of fake spring all along. So it doesn't feel so cruel this month as it usually does. But yes, yeah, so summer plans, I think when academics get asked the question of like, so are you taking the summer off because you're not teaching? Every summer, there is the predictable flurry of deeply indignant responses on this question of how much work we have to do over the summer. And I just always kind of roll my eyes at it. I think it's a little bit silly because I think the fact that we don't have to show up to any meetings, we don't have to be in the office, we can travel, we could spend the summers at home with our kids. I don't plan on doing that, but you could hypothetically. I think it's a beautiful perk of the job. And I think this is a place too, actually, to come back, like where we need to take the win, right? Like this is an incredible thing about the academic schedule. And I think we would all be less insufferable generally if we took some time off in the summer. So that is my advice to listeners, is take some time off in the summer. Go get in some water, enjoy the sun, and take advantage of the perks of this job alongside your no doubt brutal research and writing schedule.
We at the Annex are fans of summer rest time. We are junior members of the Knapp Ministry.
Excellent.
Maybe me just personally, but we definitely are in favor of rest and restoration during the summer months and whenever it's necessary. And academic life for those of us who are in the really privileged position of having like secure employment, it's a marathon. And so, being in it for the long term, and like you did with this project, which I really appreciate learning more about as we've been talking, staying open to what this project needed in order to be faithful to the story, to the city, and to the complexities and multi-layered policy environment that you're working with here, I think is a lesson for those who are trying to write in these more complex ways.
Yeah. And it took a long time to figure out how to wrangle all of that. And, I spent the better part of probably a year and a half just writing and writing and writing and writing. And I personally, I'm doing a small book tour early this summer. But after that, people keep saying, like, what are you working on now? And I'm like, I'm working on like getting to that point where I can like take my summer break, because I think too many of us work on these really heavy, really hard topics. I spent so long trying to figure out like, how do I faithfully describe this horrific killing and that horrific killing? And if you don't take those pauses, I think it's really hard to engage the work with the kind of emotional vulnerability that it deserves.
Yeah, that's really important. That's a lovely place to end in terms of thinking about the fact we're not just logic machines who are trying to figure out the patterns and the causal mechanisms, but we can be deeply emotionally impacted by the work that we do, which often does for sociologists revolve around and focus on very difficult problems and very terrible things that are done to people as a result of the way our society is organized. And so, I appreciate you bringing that in, because for most of us who do study the horrific things that people do to one another and that are done to them, keeping our own emotional lives fed is really important.
Yeah. And if I could just make in my final moments one last pitch of books people should read. My colleague Michael Walker recently published a book, Indefinite, about his experience incarcerated in jail. And one of the really powerful lessons from that book that he opens it up with is that our emotions are data, right? There isn't this kind of false binary between you can be objective or you can be emotional. Like emotions are data. And I think we need to give ourselves, writing takes time, and you need to give yourself the time to be able to feel and the openness to be able to feel, to be able to write about it in a way that really honors the full humanity of the people and topics and issues that sociologists focus on.
Well, I think your humanity and the humanity of the folks that you talk about and these systems that impact them are really clear in the book. So Dr. Michelle Phelps, thanks so much for joining us here on The Annex.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. Special thanks to Dr. Michelle S. Phelps from the University of Minnesota. Thanks also to our producer, Patterson Troop, and to Joe Cohen, who directs the Queen's Podcast Lab. Music by Lena Orsa. Thanks, Lena.